You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
This is a Ravel Podcast Network show.
Ravel.ca. You're listening to Ravel Radio, a production of Ravel.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Ravel Podcast Network. On today's show, for September 2016, I went for a drive the other day outside the city. There were lots of tractors on the road. I grew up on a farm, so I'm used to making way for slow-moving vehicles. But these tractors weren't the tractors of my childhood. They were huge. Since it's harvest season, I thought what better time to take a look at farming. And sadly, it's not the family farm we're going to be talking about with those slow tractors, the small ones that I was used to from my childhood. There's still some family farms left and still some independent farmers who are making a living for themselves, adopting new forms of sustainable agriculture. But despite the growth of organics, artisan food products, and people who are adopting farming practices that are kind to the land, the corporations continue to march across the countryside. We'll hear from a few people today who can tell us what's wrong with that. Ravel Radio, September 2016, it's about big farming. Agribusinesses have increased their lobbying capacity in the United States by some 2.5-fold since Obama came into power, according to Pat Mooney. He's one of Canada's go-to people for his perspective on technology, biodiversity, intellectual property as it relates to our food supply, and corporate control of agriculture. He spoke at the World Social Forum in August. Dave Kattenberg, the Green Planet Monitor, was there helping Ravel and gathering stuff for the Green Planet Monitor, and he let us use this excerpt.
We're at an interesting time to look at the food system, the industrial food chain, because it's really in a crisis, where it is also at a moment of great opportunity for that system, for that industrial food chain. And how it's going to play out isn't entirely clear. I'd like to be able to tell you that we understand perfectly what they're doing and how they're doing it. We don't, and they don't. And that should make us all also a bit nervous, because it's a dangerous animal, the industrial food chain, and when it feels somewhat cornered, it gets more dangerous. But it also, in being cornered, again, sees that it has ways of moving ahead now, which I think we would find extremely dangerous. We'll have time to talk about what can be done about it, because honestly, we're not in a situation where we're going to lose in the battles with the industrial food chain. We are perhaps at the best opportunity we've had in decades to think that we can win, that there's mistakes they have made, strategic errors they have made, positions that they are arguing which can be challenged rather easily. There are forces of opposition to the industrial food chain which are unexpected. And there's perhaps a clearer and sharper understanding never before in our history, I think largely due to La Via Campesina and food sovereignty, that we in civil society have a better understanding of what we can do and can articulate our positions better than we ever have before. Maybe one way of understanding where we are is to look at some of the arguments that have been made in the past that got us where we are today. Back in the 1960s and the 1970s, industry argued, the industrial food chain argued for the concept of diversity through time. They argued that, yes, we are in a state of monoculture, that's how the system works best, they said, but don't worry about it, because even though we have a monocultural system, it is creating diversity over periods of time rather than spatially over geography. And what that played out to be, and I'll explain that a bit further, is that since the 1960s, what we've really seen happen in industrialized countries, not in the global south particularly, though it's happening there as well, but particularly in industrialized countries like Canada and the United States, is a tremendous collapse in our diversity. We've seen 75% of the genetic diversity of our food crops disappear. It's not extinct, it still exists, almost all of it, but it's extinct to science. It's not where Western science can find it. It is in the fields, it's in of peasants, it's in valleys, it's in different places on small holdings of farmers. It's not in gene banks, and it's not in commercial agriculture or in commercial research even. But we've lost 75% of the genetic diversity of our food system in the industrialized countries because of that. At the same time, since the 1960s, we've lost about one-third, perhaps closer to 36%, of the species diversity of the industrial food system. The species haven't become extinct, but the number of species we actually use to feed ourselves around the world has collapsed by one-third. So again, options have disappeared. During that same time period, again, going back to the 1960s, we've lost, depending upon which species we're talking about, anywhere from 5% to much more often about 40% of the actual nutritional quality of the species that we're eating. And again, the response from industry, and I remember very clearly the director of research for DuPont Pioneer, one of the big seed companies, second largest at the moment in the world, is changing every day, argued that, yes, it's true that that's all happened, but don't worry, but we don't have diversity out there where the farmers are, we have diversity in the labs. So we'll eventually get it out. It's all there, and we're working on it. We can replace what's there very quickly with other species or other genetic variations of the crops that we depend upon. Well, that actually hasn't happened. It's not really true. But that theory that don't worry about monoculture because there's diversity in the lab has got them through a collapse of our food system, for which it's extremely hard for us to even recover today. Today, as the food industry looks at its future, trying to sort out how it's going to survive and who's going to win in the battles between different ends of the food chain, they are seeing climate change on one side as a threat that they're not quite sure how to respond to, but then also as an opportunity because they can scare us into their kind of responses. Secondly, they're seeing our concerns about food safety and food quality as a challenge to their survival as well, and trying to sort out how do they manipulate our concerns about safety and quality into something that they can control. And thirdly, they're looking at some of the opportunities around new technologies, which could give them the arguments they need to claim larger monopolies than ever before. And it's kind of hard to persuade society, you'd think, to think that monopoly is a good idea, but they are actually doing that. There's a book that came out just literally a few weeks ago called Modern Monopolies. It doesn't talk much about the food system, but it gives the argument for industry as to why it is that monopoly is now a good idea. And the argument basically is that the technologies we're dealing with now are that we need to have to survive climate change. And as Esha said, the increasing population, the theoretical 9 billion or even 10 billion people talk about for 2050, the only way we can survive that, they say, is with new technologies. New technologies require scale, enormous scale. So in fact, you need to create a platform technology which really can't allow for competition. But don't worry about that, because that platform technology means that it's a monopoly, but it'll change over time. There'll be new monopolies, which should make you feel a lot better. So whereas industry, you look at the sort of the Standard & Poor's biggest companies, the 500 big companies, they used to stay in the marketplace for 50 years, they say. Now they're staying around for only about 15 years. That's partly bullshit, actually, but there's in some cases, there's some truth to it. But they're saying, so don't worry, there's a changeover and who the corporate powers are over time. So we can allow for the monopoly because of the changeover, and because each platform technology that's brought forward into the food system will be replaced by another platform technology. So again, diversity or change or monopoly through time. And that means that they can now argue for us that the food system needs to have monopoly in order to get us through climate change. And we need to accept concentrations that we never would have accepted before. So whereas in the 1970s and 1980s, we argued against the absolute notion that seed companies and pesticide companies should come together seemed to be stupid and dangerous. Now they're saying we need to actually bring together all the links in the food chain. Not just seeds and pesticides or fertilizers or farm machinery, but also the processors and the retailers and the traders can all be part of the same system. We shouldn't be afraid of those big monopolies because we need the scale of the platform technologies to make the changes. So when we talk about what's happening now with mergers of Monsanto and Bayer or Syngenta and ChemChina or DuPont and Dow, those are really just the beginning maneuvers of a much larger change in the system that the industry clearly sees because of the threats they're facing and because of the opportunities of being able to actually claim those monopolies and make the argument for those monopolies. And they're getting away with it.
That was Pat Mooney, author and expert on the politics of food and economics. His organization, the Etc. Group, works to address social inequalities affecting the poorest people in the world, especially relating to food and agriculture. Based in Ottawa, the Etc. Group partners with organizations around the world. Thanks to Dave Kattenberg, who edited and produced this for his online magazine, The Green Planet Monitor. To read his full story, Corporate Food Chains, and to hear Pat Mooney's entire talk, you can go to greenplanetmonitor.net and look for Corporate Food. August 26th is the dateline. Up next, there are a lot fewer jobs in agriculture than there used to be because of technology, but there's still the need for people. And as in all industries, big farming needs a workforce. Agricultural work means long hours and difficult working conditions. It's hard work, low pay, and very often dangerous. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Seasonal Farm Workers Program, set up by the Pearson government in 1966. It's not a program we want to be especially proud of, though. Scott and I, of Talking Radical Radio, talked to Gabrielle Aladua, a migrant farm worker from St. Lucia, and one of the organizers of Justicia, a group which demands justice for migrant farm workers while they're in Canada.
I became a worker in 2012 as a result of a hurricane that really took me out of business. What happened is, at that time, I was self-employed, and exactly 1 year I'm running my business. And at that time, my business was diversified into five different components. And I felt so comfortable. I felt so comfortable and confident that my income is diversified. Even though one is affected, you know, I'll still be able to earn a livelihood. But just one hurricane messed up everything. And what compounded that situation was, up to now, because of the global financial crisis, we have less people traveling. Our economy is not doing well. So we have unemployment. We have really issues with unemployment. In addition to that, the hurricane made things really difficult. And making it worse still is that we depend heavily on bananas. And bananas is now infested with a serious disease called black sigatoka. And it's really difficult to control. So unemployment is high at a time when, you know, when I have a family to support and being unemployed, it's like I was at my lowest point in life. Being unemployed with a family to support, then I got the opportunity to work in Canada, which I'm really, really grateful for. When I got to Canada, I really got face to face with reality. Nothing prepared me for the conditions that I am facing in Canada. The truth is, there are 20 serious, difficult working conditions that any and all migrant farm workers are facing in Canada. These conditions are what I call the 20 dark sides of Canada. But the truth is, these conditions, they exist quietly among us, and it is because of the way the system is designed.
Walk listeners through a typical work day and typical work week for a migrant agricultural worker in Canada.
Typically, first of all, if you look at housing, there are eight of us in a room. And in the building where I live, there's 62 guys. But if only one television, can you do the mathematics there? One television for 62 guys. There were only 3 stoves with 13 burners. Can you do the mathematics? As a result of limited access to the stove, it meant that my day, a typical day for me, would start at 5, just for me to get access to the stove. A typical day would mean starting work generally at 6 or at 7, depending on the time of the year, and working minimum 10 hours. In summertime, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. Also, a typical day would mean working really, really fast. For the week, would work in excess of 60 to 70 hours and without any overtime pay. Also, every week we would have on the bulletin board a list of the different activities that we perform. And those who are at the bottom, the supervisors would come to them and tell them that your performance is below what we expect. Look at so many people are performing way above you. I do not want to see you at the bottom. You should be at the top. So they keep reminding us, they keep pushing us because they know that we are vulnerable and we cannot complain. Other serious issues would be they would remind us that back home, unemployment is high. There's 100 guys who are lined up willing to take our place. So they keep pushing us. Also, on the farm where I work and most of the farms that I've visited, a technique that's commonly used is to have people from different countries. On the farm where I live, there were the Barbadians, the St. Lucians, Jamaicans, and Guatemalans. And among us, there was that kind of competition. At the end of the day, St. Lucians want to perform or to work in such a way that we want the employer, the farm owner, to say, St. Lucians work better than Barbadians. The Barbadians want to outperform the Guatemalans. The Guatemalans want to outperform the Jamaicans. There was that kind of competition in addition to the listing of the different activities I just mentioned, which is called the variable piece rate. And it is really creating conflict and it's pushing us above and beyond what our body can normally support.
How did you first encounter Justicia, the group that you work with now?
First of all, before I came to Canada, I had really, really high expectations of Canada because one, it's because of Canada, I got the opportunity to complete a secondary school education. So in 1986, they had very limited school places in my country. And miraculously in 1986, I got the opportunity to complete a full secondary education in a school that was funded by the Canadian government. At that school, all the subjects that I studied, geography, agriculture, social studies, you cannot study this subject without studying Canada. And from the studies I did, I got the impression, and I'm pretty sure that's the impression everybody have of Canada, a place of diversity, a place where human rights is guaranteed to all, a safe place of refuge, you know? And when I got here, my expectations were that high. But when it met with reality, I met those 20 serious, difficult working conditions, which I call the dark side of Canada. And from the very word go, I wanted to vent. I wanted to do something about it. So when I met with the group, that was the first time I came across an outlet, an opportunity to fight for better conditions.
What does Justicia offer to migrant farm workers in terms of opportunities to vent and to learn and to resist?
We, the farm workers, we come to Canada and we have no idea what our rights are. It is very clear that we do not have rights, but the little that we may have, we have no idea what they are. We have no idea where to turn to. And literally, we are tied to the farm. We are cut off from the world. We do not know anything. In a country that preaches said, we know nothing. We know nowhere. So Justicia, what they do, they empower people to the limited rights that we may have. They do that by carrying out workshops and little training sessions and little solidarity activities. Like on Mother's Day, they get with the farm workers together to build some strength and basically to socialize and, you know, to get access to the little knowledge that they impact.
Are there any risks or potential downsides for workers when it comes to getting involved?
As I said, in Canada, if you have status, you have rights. If you have no status, you have no rights. And that is the vulnerability and the precariousness that we find ourselves in. So what happened is that most of the guys, they rather to better conditions than to rock the boat, than to fight for better conditions. They know that they stand the risk of being deported, right? But my philosophy is the little rights that I have is because of the sacrifice of other people. And I'm willing to fight for better conditions for workers, because if we don't do anything about it, it will just get worse, because there's no sign after 50 years, there's no sign that the conditions are getting better. Some of us are willing to take the risk and fight it all the way.
That was Gabriel Alajua, a farm worker from St. Lucia who works in greenhouses near Leamington, Ontario, so he can send money back to his family in St. Lucia. He's also an organizer with Justicia, an organization supporting migrant workers' rights in the Canadian agricultural sector. Thanks to Scott Nye and Talking Radical Radio for that excerpt. If you want to hear the entire program, go to Talking Radical Radio's most recent program on the Rebel Podcast Network. It's called Migrant Farm Workers Demanding Justice from Ottawa, and it was posted on September 28th. And finally, here's something to do if you want to hear more perspectives on our food supply, our agricultural economy, and how trends in agribusiness is affecting rural and urban life in Canada. Lois Ross is one of our newer columnists, and we're really glad she's here. She's a communications specialist, writer, and editor living in Ottawa. Her column with Rabble discusses issues that are key to food production here in Canada, as well as internationally. Lois has a background in many different areas, and she could have done her column on labor, or on international development, or a whole bunch of other topics. So I asked her, why agriculture?
I have worked in a lot of different fields in terms of, international development and labor and health and so many more over the years, and primarily for nonprofit organizations. But I really cut my teeth on agricultural issues and food issues and community issues, if you like, because I grew up on a family farm in southern Saskatchewan, and it was a progressive farm. So, we sat around the kitchen table and talked about a lot of issues, and I learned early on that food, agriculture, and sustainability are really the foundations of all other issues. Whether that be development here at home or development elsewhere, or health, or how community works together in cooperation. So when, as I've read Rabble over the years and all of the topics that they cover and how much I've admired, the work that people put into creating content for Rabble, when I was approached about writing a column, I thought agriculture would be a good fit.
And so how have you've been writing for Rabble now for, been about 6 months now?
Yeah, 6 months, since the spring of 2016.
And how have you decided which columns you want to choose? There are so many different issues out there. How have you decided what kinds of issues you want to focus on?
Well, the first thing I did was do a bit of an environmental scan. So I took a look at the issues and updated myself, if you like, on what's going on, what has changed, what hasn't changed. Because over the years, I have done quite a bit of work in writing in agriculture, but some of it wasn't that recent. So I did an environmental scan of what the issues are currently, and some, unfortunately, have not changed all that much. And, the players have changed, perhaps the names have changed, but the fundamental issues haven't changed.
What ones haven't changed?
Well, the ones that haven't changed, I think, are the issues related to seed and to diversity and to seed control. The other issues that have not changed and perhaps just gotten worse are the actual, corporate control over seed and farm inputs. And then the other major issue that hasn't changed is land and what's happening to land globally, but also in Canada. So issues of land concentration, accessibility to land, land tenure, who farms, who owns the land? How can you afford to farm? Those things haven't really changed. They've only, in fact, and I don't want this to be too negative because it tends to paralyze people, but they've gotten worse, the issues. But the positive thing is that more people seem to understand these issues. That, I think, is the hopeful message in the column and what I'm learning as I research the column, because the columns are very heavily researched. It's not sort of top of my head, it's they're heavily researched, and the research has shown me that there's more people that are involved in the issues, more people that care, and that says to me that there's more possibility of change.
So you are a prairie woman, born and bred. What does that contribute to your sense of agriculture? Is it different than if you were an eastern woman, for example, from the Maritimes?
Well, if I was from the Maritimes, which is another resource economy, I would probably be writing more about the fishery, perhaps. But, I mean, there are a lot of farmers in the Maritimes, too, and I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different models of agriculture in Canada as well as around the world. I think that the fact that I grew up out west, on the prairies, I learned early on about what the harm that the industrial model of agriculture can create to community and to people, to health, to economies and to sustainability. So because the farms there are just so huge, and even when I was a kid, they were larger than, say, farms in Ontario, and the population was sparser. So I really lived in my lifetime, and I guess in my parents' generation, understood the settling of the West and also the unsettling of the West, because of issues related to land concentration and corporate farming and the corporate model of agriculture. So I bring that perspective to the work that I do. I think that if I had been raised in Ontario, perhaps on an 80-acre farm, I might not have had the opportunity to learn what I learned about industrialized agriculture.
And now you live in Ottawa, in the middle of the city. So what can city people get from your column, and why is it important that they're aware of these issues?
Well, we're talking fundamentally about food and community and health and the environment. So I think that it's important for people to know how their food is grown, why people want to grow it, what has happened to Canadian agriculture and what's happening, and what's happening to, you know, to issues such as seed and diversity here at home and around the world. And the fact is it's fundamental. It's as important an issue, I think, or darn close to it, as water. So, you know, I mean, people read what they will, and sometimes people look for this kind of information. Other times people stick their head in the sand because they feel disempowered, but I think that information is power. And so that's why I would think that people should read it, because while it's not perhaps all a rosy picture, it is information, and I hope it's presented in a way that empowers.
That was Lois Ross, our agriculture and food production columnist on Rabble.ca. Her latest column focuses on corporate land grabbing. Sounds nasty? It is, but it's important to know about. And that's our program for September 2016, Big Farming. We've heard some nasty stuff, but just a reminder that there's lots of good things happening in farming too. So while the weather's nice, go to a farmer's market. Support the farmers near you who are still trying to make a go of it on their own piece of land, producing food in a way that sustains the earth and us. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Rabble Radio is a production of Rabble.ca. And don't forget, Rabble needs your support too, so that we can continue to support the efforts of people who are trying to make Canada a better country and the world a better place. Go to rabble.ca/donate. Support independent media. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next time.